Welcome to the Fat Theory Book Club, everyone. My name's Amanda Levitt. If you haven't heard of me, I'm a PhD candidate from the Department of Sociology at Wayne State University in Detroit, Michigan. That is a mouthful, and I say it way too much. I've also worked in the fat liberation movement for almost 20 years, starting off as, kind of a lurker online and then moving to doing in-person organizing and then officially moving to grad school. You may know me, or some people may know me, from my work with Abundant Bodies. It's a network gathering at Allied Media Conference that happens, it's now happening biannually, so it happens every other summer. Abundant Bodies is a network gathering that centers the experiences of Indigenous, Black, people of color, disabled, supersized, trans, and queer fat folks. I've also spent way too much time tweeting at Fat Body Politics on Twitter. And now to my amazing guest, Tigris Osborne is the chair of the board of NAFA, the National Association to Advance Fat Acceptance. She is the founder of Full Figured Entertainment in Oakland, California, and co-founder with activist blogger Nicolette Duchin Parkhurst of Red Street Girl, PHX Fat Force in Phoenix, Arizona. Tigris is a two-time women's college graduate with degrees in Africana Studies and creative writing. She is an intersectional feminist teacher and writer whose professional background as a youth advocate, diversity educator, and equity and inclusion consultant informs the fat liberation activism she has engaged in since 2008. You can follow Tigris as Eye of the Tigris, which I have to say is the best social media name ever, on your favorite social media sites. But I had a good giggle when I saw that that was your handle. Hi, welcome to Fat Theory Book Club.
Can I tell the little story of how that became my handle?
Yes, you absolutely can.
I worked as the diversity, back then we just said diversity educator, but the diversity, equity, and inclusion director is probably what my title would be now. Mm-hmm. And the kids had an open mic assembly twice a week, and one time they asked us all to have a theme song, so of course I made Eye of the Tiger my theme song, and I was like, I'm gonna start using Eye of the Tigress everywhere. But eyeofthetigress.com was already owned by someone, and it actually was like a weird fitness thing that I don't want to endorse in any way. So I was like, well, I am gonna do stuff from the eye perspective, so I'll just use the other kind of eye. So it's letter I of the Tigress. That's how I ended up with that many years ago.
Yes, good thing to point out. It is IOFTHETIGRESS. It is not I like I. It is I like the letter I.
But I do encourage the singing of the Eye of the Tigress song from Rocky with it adjusted as Tigress. I encourage that.
I feel like if you ever do like a public event where you need to have a theme song, you absolutely are required to have Eye of the Tiger as it now, because that's just like so great. And you can just change every tiger to tigress and it'll be perfect.
Yep.
So I did create a little outline for this because, both of us are teachers and this is how we do things. Welcome everyone that has already shown up. So I guess the first question that I wanted to kind of go over was why a book club? I've been in the fat liberation movement for a really long time. And over the last 10 years or so, many people in the movement know that the body positivity movement has really overtaken and really pulled a lot of its work from fat liberation without giving fat liberation its due. And I really wanted to create a space for us as activists to really dig into the labor and work that fat activists and fat liberationists have done over the last 50 years, while also educating everyone and, kind of just creating a space that allows for people to really get a very critical understanding of fat theory, fat studies work, and the type of literature that's available. If you haven't been to my website, amanda-levitt.com, you can find a now over 80 book list of fat related books that I think are a really good place to start. But it's also a lot of books. And so I am going to be very purposeful as a sociologist to really give us a good basis for where to start and how to really think about fatness, not as something that's a pathology, but instead something that is a form of embodiment, that it's a body type, and it is a political identity. And so, you know, this is in so many ways is my dream course to teach. I mean, I'm a PhD candidate. And so, you know, we don't really have that much control over what courses we get to teach. And we don't have, you know, even if I were to go on and be tenured faculty member, the ability to teach a fat studies, fat theory course is pretty few and far between. And so I thought, why not just make it online? I'm fine with doing things myself if no one will let me. And so this book club is really going to explore fatness. Specifically, it's going to explore fat identity, fat embodiment, and the structural and institutional barriers that fat people experience on a daily basis. I'm always going to try to, and anyone who's followed my work knows this, I'm always going to try to pull us away from just talking about individual experiences and behaviors or beliefs and really think about it as a systemic and institutional experience. And, you know, that's my jam. That's what I love doing. And I really want to kind of pull people along with me to get there. And so there's a couple of things that I just want to go off the top. I'm not going to talk about these after today. These are kind of just the rules for joining my digital classroom, particularly if we're talking about fatness. You know, there's I put some big fat myths that I'm not going to go into detail with. I'm just going to list them. But some big fat myths that I think are really important to put out there and then say, hey, we're going to show how these myths are not true. But the big fat myth that I have is that fatness is a disease. It's not. And please come along with us as I show you with all of the guests that I am going to have, show you why that's not true. Second one is all fat people are sick. Again, we're going to pull away from this idea that fatness is a pathology and that fat bodies are inherently diseased. That's not true. And then the third one is fat people can easily become thin people. Again, a lot of research behind this that shows that that's absolutely not true. And, you know, I just wanted to get that out of the way so that then we can move on. And so now I have what are going to be my rules of fat theory book club. Fat people have the right to exist without changing their bodies. Pretty basic idea. Second, there is absolutely no diet or weight loss talk. Now, that doesn't mean that we're not going to talk about health. We're not going to talk about and try to deconstruct the way that health is treated in mainstream or dominant, you know, narratives around health and weight. But we aren't going to be talking about how you can lose weight. We're not going to be talking about, you know, behaviors that you should be engaging in. Instead, I really want us to think critically about fatness and fat embodiment and start thinking about the ways that we have been taught to think about fatness through the media and other social institutions, and instead kind of flip it on its head with all of the literature that is in there, that is available on that, again, that long book list that I have on my website. So, Tigress, you already saw my questions. How are you feeling about this?
I feel excited. I see some people I know are watching. Hello to you. Hello and nice to meet you to all the people I don't know. I feel like there was some buzz around this from people. So I'm excited to be part of the inaugural episode. And I'm a book nerd. I've got a stack of books here. You know, one of my favorite things about Amanda's Instagram is she has a picture of her bookshelf that has all of this. This is only part of my fat liberation bookshelf, but anyway, I'm a book nerd, so I'm super excited about this. It was good timing for me because when I became chair of NAFA, or gearing up to become chair of NAFA, I started thinking about all those fat liberation books that were on my reading list that I either hadn't read yet or that I wanted to revisit from, you know, from deeper within my own activism than I was when I first encountered them. And so I was sort of designing my own, like, I was calling it my independent PhD in fat studies, and it looks a lot like the reading list that you came up with. So it was actually like perfect timing. Kismet, is that the word?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, part of this is I've been, you know, I'm working on my dissertation, and one of the things that, you know, to be real for a bit, is like I was in a car accident a few years ago, and it kind of took the steam out of me because I'm dealing with chronic pain. I did physical therapy for about 9 months after the accident, and like I spent most of that time because I had passed my competency, my preliminary exams, and so I did all of the reading I had to be certified as a gender scholar, but I needed to kind of step back and start looking at fat literature. And so much has come out within the last 3 or 4 years. It's amazing to me. And it's like so exciting. And so there's so many different books that I want to read, but also like, this is a good way for me to really think about how I want to, you know, formulate my dissertation. And I thought that this would be like a really fun journey to bring other people on, because I know that there are so many people that, you know, are interested in fat liberation and maybe don't have aspirations to go to grad school. I totally get it. I'm in grad school. It's hell half the time. You know, and
well, and it's aspiration and it's access and it's, you know, like if there are all kinds of reasons why we need to move, like even when we're still engaging with sort of academic stuff, like some of the books on your list are super academic. Some of them are more like personal memoir. That's the same with my fat studies self-designed course, is like I am happy to do the high level nerd, like the high nerd level shit, and also I swear, everybody, I'm just giving you a heads up, I'm happy to do that, like that deeply academic work, and I also just want to hear people tell their stories sometimes. And I think there's a great combo that can happen from you know, accessing material like of both types, and sometimes that doesn't happen in the academy, right? Like sometimes it's really seeing one kind of narrative or one narrative style. And so doing it with, you know, like being able to talk with people who have sort of a foot in the academic world, but also a foot outside the academic world, I think is a really, it's like a great meeting space for people who are interested in books they would never read and want to have somebody else sort of work through it with them, but also for like who want to talk about books that they have read that might not get talked about in a traditional classroom. So I think it's great.
Yeah, and I really want to, I mean, and you know this because you've seen the questions that I'm going to ask, but like a lot of them are not just because I want to know you and want everyone else to know you, but I really want to really get people involved in thinking about an activist journey. Like we are both people that have been in the community for a very, very long time. And so many people that I talk to either don't know how to begin doing activism themselves, or just don't know the process that other activists have gone through to get where they are. And so I really want to, you know, kind of break down those, you know, that the barriers for people to one, be able to learn from fat activists who've been around and authors and academics, but as you said, make it accessible for people in a wide range of disability status, but also make it accessible because I think, you know, the first wave feminism consciousness raising sessions were so powerful. And I think that having something on a platform like Instagram and doing it as a podcast will really be a good place to kind of make that, you know, to meld that, those two things together, all of those different things together. I'm also nosy as hell, and I just like asking people questions. And I like, you know, I like seeing how people respond to things. You know, no one that comes on here is going to come on without knowing the questions that I'm asking. People will notice that, you know, that I'm asking very similar questions. Part of that is like, I think the researcher in me that wants to see how people answer it. But I also just think, you know, it's nice to hear like people's origin stories and, you know, and see how did they get involved in this, and like what type of experiences that they had as a fat person, and how did they find fat community, and what has that been like? Because it's like, you know, activism is not always a fun thing. You know, the first time I started a nonprofit, it lasted for about 3 years, but it was also like the beginning of me realizing I had PTSD, and like my ability to handle stress in the way that that you need to be able to handle stress when running a nonprofit is not there. So, you know, it changes, and that's okay. But, you know, I think that often Oh, sorry, yes.
Well, I was just going to say, also, I think one of the things that people feel like, and I especially want to emphasize this since I'm here and I'm the chair of a formal organization, right? Yeah. That is not the only way to do activism. That's not the way I started doing activism. That's not the way most people are doing activism. Like, you don't have to work in a, like, there's great resources that nonprofits have, or ways that we can, like, leverage our history as an official organization and things like that, that, you know, I'll talk about a little bit when we get into some of the history stuff, but like, sometimes what activism looks like is, you know, is posting that selfie.
Oh yeah.
You know, sometimes what activism looks like is eating that sandwich at the cafe in front of people and not worrying about what people think about a fat person eating. Sometimes what activism looks like is, you know, is speaking up for yourself at the doctor's office. So like, that's the thing, is like, there are so many varied entry points into activism, and doing something like being a member of NAFA or being on a committee somewhere or whatever, like, that's only one kind of it, right? And so and that shows in all these, like, some of the narratives that come out of the books that you've picked out. It shows when you start talking to people who've been, you know, in the movement, and it has a lot to do with the pieces of movement history that we don't talk enough about. So I think that's really important to emphasize for folks, that, like, you ain't got to have a title to be an activist. If you declare yourself a fat activist, you're a fat activist. You know, what do you tell us about what you're doing, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that we, you know, there's so many different ways to do it. You know, but a lot of the work that I do for Abundant Bodies is, like, the day of, I go and, like, pick up food and, like, do a lot of the work of, like, making sure that the space is available. But I let my co-coordinators be the ones that are there and are, you know, facilitating, I can't speak always, but facilitating things. And, you know, and I think that once you become a more seasoned activist, you understand that. But I really want to kind of get us to go back to that nitty gritty, which is why one of the first books that I want us to read is Marilyn Wan's book, Fat So. And it's one, it's because, you know, Marilyn's book, oh, you're going to pull it out. Yes. Mine is in my bedroom, I think. So I'm not prepared. Thank you, Tyrus. You know, I think it's a really good book to start with, because one, it's fun. I think that fat community, we talk about how fatness is a form of queer embodiment. And that is, like, a very, like, highfalutin academic term, but that, you know, it's a deviant body type. But at the same time, we don't talk about how so much of fat activism history is, like, so campy and fun and silly and just, you know, I mean,
and so, like, much. And so I think, much.
Yeah. And, like, the camp, like, for me, just, it makes me so happy. You know, some of the earliest things I did as an activist was go and take one of Marilyn Wan's Yay scales. And for people that don't know, it's a scale that Marilyn would pull apart. And instead of having it showing someone's weight when they stand on it, it gives you a compliment. And, you know, and she had hers. It was, like, you know, covered in, like, pink fur fabric. And glitter. It was just so much. Yeah, so much fun. I think the first one I ever made, I painted, like, a rainbow on it. And, you know, but that was just such a small thing. We just did, like, a guerrilla activism thing where we went down to Hart Plaza in Detroit during Motor City Pride. And just, like, as people were walking in, we were having them jump on the Yay scale. And it was some of the most fulfilling moments as an activist was doing that. Like, I vividly remember a younger Black woman. She's probably a little bit younger than me. And I was, like, in my early-ish 20s. And she was, you know, a fat woman. And she was, like, very nervous about getting on the scale, because she was with a group of, like, thin friends. But she got on the scale and, like, it said perfect when she got on the scale, and she, like, started crying and I started crying. And it was just, like, one of those moments that, like, yes, it's joy, but it's also transformative for people. And I think doing these really fun things are, you know, is what makes me really excited about doing activism and being part of the community. But it's also, you know, that's, again, as you said, a very specific form of activism. And there's a lot of ways that people, and this is something that I'm hoping will come out of reading a lot of these different books, is that sometimes changes in institutions happen through small, you know, small little moments. You know, it can be, as someone in the comments said, you know, we could talk about policy changes and creating policy, but you know, if all of us work in a place that, you know, we, most of us have jobs, we engage with institutions, whether you're in school or you have, you know, are working at, you know, Michaela, I know you work at a public library. There's a lot of different places where we can start thinking about how we can make those institutions more accessible for fat people, but also how we can challenge anti-blackness and ableism and fat phobia and homophobia and all of these other things as well. And so that's kind of, you know, again, I'm going to keep saying this is my jam. I really love talking about this stuff, but I think that, you know, again, I think it doesn't have to be that you are the person going out and doing guerrilla activism or, you know, putting posters up or putting yourself out there. It can be that you're making little moments in your daily life to make fatness less stigmatized and more accepted. So,
yeah. Yeah. Can I just saw Michaela's comment, libraries rock. Libraries do rock. Libraries are under attack right now. If you're a supporter of public library, please show your public librarians in where you live some love. And I know you, one of your questions is about first books we love. And I want to talk about finding my first book in the library.
Okay, but first.
Yes, but first.
I have another question that I want to start off with because I'm also really excited when I have a thin person on to ask this question in reverse, but when was the first time you knew you were fat?
The earliest clear memory I have of knowing I was fat was in fifth grade when at some point there was a conversation on the playground. I don't know if we had been weighed at school. I don't like it's vague. I don't know if we had been weighed at school or if it just was a conversation that kind of organically, you know, fifth graders on the playground talking about their weight. But it really sort of like makes me think about how fifth grade is actually kind of young. I mean, fifth grade is actually kind of old, according to like what research tells us about how early girls especially start to notice their weight. But there was a conversation about weight and everybody was saying their weight and it was, I had never felt like I was any bigger than my classmates, but my weight was 20, 30 pounds higher than my classmates. And it's the first time I ever remember noticing it. And, you know, I can think of other moments in junior high school, in high school where, you know, other people pointed out things about my body or people in my family made comments about my body and things like that. But that moment on the playground of, you know, of talking, of just like realizing that I thought we were all the same and all of a sudden there was a marker that was different and it was very clear that that was the wrong thing to do.
Yeah, I mean, I think for, and part of the reason I'm really interested in asking this question is because I think most people, I would be very surprised if anyone who I ask has a story that is not traumatic in some way or another. Because fat stigma is so real and so ingrained in our, you know, in our culture and in society and the way that we're taught this from such a young age about what is acceptable and what isn't. You know, a long time ago, I wrote a post about bullying and about how bullying really is social inequalities. And often the targets of that are people that are, you know, that don't fit this very specific box of what is acceptable, which is someone who's white, cis, thin, able-bodied, straight, you know, and when you break out of that, you know, you are labeled in a way. And so, you know, I don't think. Well,
and I think my first, sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. My first experience with recognizing that fat stigma existed in the world was probably much earlier than that because I can remember people talking about my fat aunt, right? And and you know, like as a kid, I thought my fat aunt was gigantic, and my fat aunt wasn't really that fat. I mean, she was what we would probably today in fat activist community call a small fat or maybe a medium fat, but you know, people who are not in sort of fat world and thinking about privilege as it is stratified according to how small or large of a fat you are often just don't have any sense of like how big people are. They don't interact with enough, like they know a fat person, or they have the fat person they think of, or the fat person they see on TV or whatever, and they don't understand like that sort of full spectrum. And so you can be in these spaces where people are described as very, very fat who are not very fat. And in fact, that was part of my coming of age as a teenager, you know, being made to feel that I was very, very fat when I actually wasn't very fat. You know, and there are times when I'm made to feel like I'm very, very fat now, that I am kind of, you know, I'm pretty fat, you know, and then there are other people who are fatter and who face more stigma and who face more physical limitations in the world and like all of those kinds of things. And, you know, but there's no context for it. The only context is there's a line here where thinness stops, and that line can move whenever we want it to, socially, in our families, according to comparison of whoever's around us. But if you're on the wrong side of the line, your body is wrong. So that dynamic, I think I was probably aware of before it was like applied to me, because something made it real for me through numbers and through classmates' conversation or whatever. You know, I was well aware in the world that there was like, there were fat people and thin people, and you weren't supposed to be one of the fat people. It's just that time in fifth grade was probably the first time I realized I fit in one or another of those categories. Mm-hmm. You know, and I was a pretty slim little kid. I was growing up in the 80s, children's sizing had, you know, a numerical size, and then it had a slim, regular, or husky cut. And I can remember other people in my family being shamed for being the husky cut, but I was the slim cut. You know, as a slim cut kid, it never occurred to me that I'd be like a husky cut adult, you know, according to that language or whatever. You know, and now I'm 47 and I'm like a, you know, triple husky or whatever they would call it. I don't know what they would call it now, but like, but that idea that like, you know, there were labels for different kinds of bodies, and there were associations with those labels. But that moment in fifth grade was when I realized I had moved into one of the categories of negative association, and that I was going to have to, you know, think about that. I'd never had to think about it in relationship to me before. I'd only thought about it in what I saw on TV, or, you know, like I said, other people in my family.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, I didn't realize fat was bad until I was like in sixth grade. Cause I also like started gaining weight during puberty, and so that really changed my body type. But it also, yes, Michaela, triple husky is a great drag name. I absolutely agree. Someone needs to pull that and take it. But
triple husky, Q-U-E.
Yeah, it was, but also like I had a very weird childhood because my parents put me into beauty pageants, and I was definitely not like Toddlers and Tiara's beauty pageants, but it was still enough where I was really taught that my body was a commodity at a very young age, and that being young, you know, being pretty was valuable.
I thought I had put my phone on do not disturb, so I don't know why it's ringing. I'm sorry if that interrupted you. I heard not Toddlers and Tiara's beauty pageants, and then I couldn't hear you for a second.
Yeah, so it wasn't Toddlers and Tiaras, but I definitely learned from a really young age that I was pretty. I mean, obviously, like, I am a fair-skinned white lady, and, you know, I, you know, very early on learned that prettiness was, like, the thing that was valuable about me, but then once I became fat in, like, sixth grade, it was, like, all of that value was, like, ripped away, and so, you know, and so I always think about, because there was that shift, you know, and that moment when you realize that you're doing something wrong, that I think is really fascinating. Because obviously, like, I think we have many other moments in our life where it becomes worse. You know, I think that the next time that it was really bad was I was playing powder puff football, and I had to go to the doctor to get like medical approval for it. And it was the first time that I was told I was obese and that I needed to lose weight. You know, I'd always been told by kids and that I wasn't okay. And then I had an aunt who told me how beautiful I'd be if I was thin when I was like in, like, it was at the end of sixth grade. It was after being like spending the whole year just being bullied relentlessly. And then being like having it be medicalized. And so there was that, that long process of it. And I think we don't think about those processes and I always think about it for, you know, for parents who are worried about having, you know, if they have fat kids, worrying about, you know, I'm not worried about what I'm more worried about what is going to happen to their kids, not how and how they can protect themselves from the world. Whereas like I've had family members that were concerned about making sure that their, you know, kid didn't become fat because they didn't want to deal with fat stigma. And so I like really trying to shift it to how can we make, you know, make it so that when a kid finds out they're fat, it's like, okay, your body's different than mine. That's okay. And we like move on and like go be kids, you know? And so that's kind of why I'm always interested in hearing how people learned that they were fat, even though I know that it is going to be in many cases kind of a traumatic experience, but I'm using you as my like guinea pig for this. And I love explaining why I'm doing things. So now going back to books, what was the first book that you can think of that you had like a very fond memory of?
Well, so the first book in general that I thought of when I read the question is a book by Brenda Wilkerson called Liddell. And I discovered it in my public library. I used to walk from my neighborhood to the local public library. I loved my school's library, but when I learned that I could, you know, have the independence to walk to the library and get books on my own that I wasn't competing with my classmates for, whoever one of the most popular, whatever everybody in fifth grade was reading or whatever. And what was really powerful about Liddell for me is that it's a book that was published in the 70s. I was encountering it in the 80s. And it was the first book I ever read that that made use of Black vernacular. And really, you know, had a lot of the dialogue in what, you know, scholars would call AAVE, African American mm-hmm. Vernacular English. I would just call it like, sounded like Black folks. And it sounded like my neighborhood. It sounded like, and these were, the characters were, the book is set in the South and the characters were Southern. I'm from the Southwest, but in the Black side of my family, everybody is from the South. There's a lot of, you know, Southern accent and Southern dialect in the way that my family talks and in the way my neighborhood talked. And so it was really like the first time, you know, I was a little nerdy kid getting bused to a different area for school where I was one of the only Black kids in this honors program almost every year. You know, and there were some things I didn't experience in terms of racism as like a light skinned mixed race Black kid, but there was always that othering, always. And there was never anything in school that had anything to do with my neighborhood, that side of my family. Mm-hmm. You know, I think like in first grade, there was one time we made collages for Black History Month and I brought some Ebony magazines. Like it was like that. And so discovering that book was just so like, it just like opened my world, like opened my eyes to the possibility, opened my heart, opened my mind to the possibility that, that everybody's story could be in a book, you know? And I was mm-hmm. so enchanted by books. Like I was that kid that I had the weekly readers book subscription or whatever, and the books would come to my grandparents' trailer. And, you know, like I can still remember like the joy of like opening the little cardboard box and getting my little two books out or whatever. That was when I lived in a more rural area where I wasn't close to the library. And I was lucky to have people who read to me and who bought me books. But, you know, so I've had a love affair with books from the very beginning, but I had, and I had seen, you know, as a child, I loved the book The Snowy Day, which the artwork features, you know, like a Black protagonist or a brown skin protagonist, at least. And A Button for Corduroy. Like, you see, I'm getting all excited about these children's books that I read. You know, and A Button for Corduroy is about this little stuffed bear, but it has a little Black girl in it. But the language didn't reflect my neighborhood of where I, you know, lived later in my childhood and stuff. So that was super powerful for me. In terms of, like, first fat books, you know, around the same time I encountered three fat books, like in a pretty short time period around the same time in the late 90s. We already mentioned Marilyn Wand's Fatso. And for those of you who are, listening, not watching, it's Fat ! So ! And it was like just that title, which came from Marilyn's zine before the book was published. That title, that like the challenge in that title of so what if I'm fat, you know, was remarkable. And the color is like, the cover is like a bright cover with a like cartoonish artistic rendering of this like fat woman in a short dress. And if you actually have the book, you can do like a thumb thing and she dances. Like it's like a, I don't know if y'all can see this, those of you who are watching, but it's probably too tiny for you to see, but you do that thing and then the little fat lady dances and it's fantastic. And this book was really incredible to me. Cameron Manheim's Wake Up, I'm Fat, which is a memoir from the actress who was really popular at the time on a show called The Practice, and who won an Emmy. And when she got her Emmy, she stood up and said, "This is for all the fat girls." And then, of course, Denise Austin, you know, acted like an ass, and then whatever. But like, but Cameron wrote this book, and it was like on bookshelves, a declaration. I am fat. I don't have to not say that I'm fat because I am. And then the third one in my early fat journey in the 90s was Laura Fraser's Losing It, which is an examination of the diet industry. It was the first time that I had seen like a critical, it was the first time I had seen discussion of the diet industry that wasn't just like, good job, they're making fat people healthy. Like that wasn't mm-hmm. just sort of like Richard Simmons hugging people and crying, like, you know, Susan Powder screaming about stopping the insanity. Like this book is critical of all those things, like takes apart, asks questions of all of those things. Mm-hmm. I think revisiting it now, it could be more aggressively fat positive, and it certainly is still positioned in some ways that don't challenge the some of the paradigms you talked about at the beginning about like fat being unhealthy or fat being inherently unhealthy mm-hmm. or inherently diseased or whatever. But for me, it was like such a great starting place of just like, oh, apply critical thinking to these messages about what the diet industry is instead of just mm-hmm. accepting it as like the thing that's supposed to help fat people. First of all, do fat people even need to be helped? And second of all, is it helping them? And it really mm-hmm. sort of framed for me, I don't think I would have been able to articulate it this way at the time, but it really sort of framed for me just how much capitalism drives the diet industry, mm-hmm. not concern for fat people. In any way.
Yeah.
Like, not even, like, concern, trolley, weird, fake concern for the, not even that. Just money. Just the money.
Yeah.
So, those were my personal book nostalgia, and then my, like, fat girl book nostalgia.
Yeah, I mean, I think, and you know, as I said a little bit earlier, like, the reason that I really wanted to choose Marilyn's book, one, I jokingly refer to her as my fat mother. she accepts that title. You know, I mean, literally when I was 18, I heard about Marilyn Juan and she was like my hero for so long. And then, you know, getting to meet her was like, literally I was over the moon for it. But also like, it's a really interesting place to start when thinking about the fat liberation movement, because Marilyn's, you know, book came off of, as you said, a zine, but also came off of the Fatso Forum that she had online, which is literally the first fat-related online space to talk about fatness in a way that wasn't stigmatizing and that was moved out of this realm of thinking about it as a state that has to be transitionary to being a thin person. And I think that that is, you know, a really amazing part of fat history that is kind of lost because there's been so many different changes. You know, blogs became a thing, particularly after 2000. And then, you know, we had the Live Journal, and I can't think of the name of it right now, but the, you know, it became really popular on Live Journal. And, you know, the fashion movement from LiveJournal and people really connecting that way. There still were blogs and other things going on, but then the move to like Tumblr and other social media and Facebook and Instagram and TikTok and all of these other things have really allowed for fat liberation to kind of explode onto the internet. And I really like getting us kind of back to the source and thinking about it, and also like thinking about how radical that book is and was in the late 90s, because Marilyn Juan's book has images of butts and images of chins and arms and all of these other things. You know, it's It's all white butts and all.
You
white
know, I'm not trying to show y'all the butts. It's all light skin butts. My butt looks like this too, but you know, it's light skin butts, but not necessarily gay butts.
That's a good point. Thank you for calling me out on that. You are very true. It is light skin butts.
But there could definitely be more skin tone variety in the butts and bellies. I can't find the butts, but here are the bellies, y'all. You should. You know, I have not revisited Marilyn's book in the whole, like as a whole. There are the bellies. I have not revisited the book as a whole. You know, I pick it up from time to time and flip through it. I do the little, you know, the flip girl dancing, but I also flip through it and read different things. Or like, oh, when I read this the first time, I didn't know who Sandra Solovey was. But if you don't know who Sandra is one of the most important lawyers in fat justice work ever of like all time. And there's a piece by her in here. And she supports the work of the FLAIR project, which is a fat legal rights education project. And but like, you know, so I pick it up from time to time. I am sure that there are some concepts in here that are dated. I'm sure that there are things that, you know, one of the things I really admire about Marilyn is like Marilyn will own where she makes mistakes. Like Marilyn would be in agreement with you the Marilyn I know would be in agreement with you. Like I should have worked harder to find some more skin tone variety in showing these bodies or whatever. I appreciate that Marilyn shares her learning that way so that other people can learn from it. And I'm sure there's stuff in here that if she were writing it today or we're reading it today, feels a little bit like the 90s, but some of it doesn't. Some of it feels like right now. And it's, you know, it's worth taking, it's definitely worth taking a look at. But also, like, Marilyn's the second wave of fat activism. A lot of people, a lot of people who entered during that period that you're talking about, when fat activism, and then later a more watered down version, often of body positivity, when those things exploded on the internet, a lot of people who came into the movement during that time think that that was the beginning. So it's not just that they don't know that Marilyn was the beginning. Marilyn's not the beginning. Marilyn's this, like Marilyn's second generation to this movement, and so there's a lot of history.
And we, you know, I have, and this is a really good question to have, but I do appreciate you pointing that out. My point of starting with Marilyn was because it is kind of that happy medium between where fat liberation began, but then where fat liberation went to where it is now, because it went from, you know, we went from, and what you're going to talk about, the founding of NAFA, the Fat Underground, and all of that work that was happening, that was in person, on the ground, organizing, and really getting back to those activist roots of where fat liberation began. But I really like to see like where that the online and the internet like origin story is. But I do also like that I think it is a kind of a second wave, the beginning of a second wave. And, you know, and because there isn't like, you know, there aren't fat histories written. I mean, I know that there have been, you know, books on the list that I put together that talk about fat history and the liberation movement over time. But there, you know, it isn't as widely known as other activist movements and social movements, you know, particularly, you know, the feminist movement and civil rights movement. Those two, you know, are written about and known in so many different ways. And so I really wanted to kind of get that going and kind of try to create a, you know, digital documentation with people that have been around. I mean, I'm, you know, trying to, as I was talking to you before this, that I'm trying to get Lynn McPhee, who is one of the founders of the Fat Underground and wrote, was one of the collaborators of the Fat Liberation Manifesto. I'm really hoping to get her onto this project and so many other people. But my last question before we move on to you talking about NAFA is, what was your earliest memory of the fat liberation movement?
So I encountered, fat liberation activists who were almost certainly members of NAFA, through daytime talk shows first. You know, shows like Donahue, you know, they would have every, you know, once a year, there would be this sort of like the, like, is it okay to be fat? Listen to these fat people say it's okay kind of episode on all of those sort of like 80s and 90s talk shows, Donahue, Sally Jessy Raphael, Montel Williams, all those. And so I am certain that I saw fat people on, saw fat activists on there then, even though I did not know the term fat activism, right? Mm-hmm. The first person I encountered who was like a real life representative of that movement was Carrie Hemingway, who was part of NAFA's Boston chapter. Boston used to have like chapters in many cities across, NAFA used to have chapters in many cities across the country, and a couple of Canadian chapters. And now we're just sort of centralized as an online organization. But in those chapter years, Carrie was really active in the Boston chapter, and I was a young student at Smith College, which is a couple hours outside of Boston. And during Otilia Cromwell Day, which was the diversity day at Smith, you know, like no regular classes, there were just like, it was like a workshop day of all this different kind of diversity programming. Carrie did a workshop on NAFA and fat rights. And that would have been the fall of 1992. I was 17 or 18 years old. That was my first exposure mm-hmm. to NAFTA. And like the idea that like there's a group of people who just use the word fat and they're not mm-hmm. just like those handful of people I saw on TV or on Donahue. But I didn't get involved with fat activism until years later, but that's what put it on my radar. And then I soon after that discovered BBW Magazine, which was a plus size fashion magazine, Big Beautiful Woman. I know that that term now is often associated with nightlife or with adult industry or with, you know, certain like party communities in fat world, and less with political movement. But at the time that magazine was a piece of mainstream fat visibility. There were some other fat publications, Radiance and mm-hmm. Dimensions and things like that. But I couldn't find Radiance and Dimensions in B. Dalton Bookstore or Walden Books, which were these yeah. sort of like particular mall bookstores of my coming of age years. And so BBW was a great visibility piece, and it also had advertisements in the back. So I would see like things that were happening in other parts of the country, fat dances, you know, NAFA meetings, things like Border Maryland's zine, or, you know, these other people who were producing. There was a lot of zine culture in the 90s. I mean, relatively speaking, a lot of zines that had, you know, representing specific fat communities like fat dyke zines and things like that. Mm-hmm. And so I didn't have access to those from where I was. By that time, I was probably back here in Arizona. I wasn't getting access to a lot of zines in a small town in Arizona, but I could at least, you know, I could at least see that there were things bubbling out there in the world through those mm-hmm. advertisements in the back of BBW Magazine.
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's, you know, I remember all of those. I mean, I graduated high school in 2004, and so it was a little bit after that, but I still remember all of those, like, weird, you know, talk shows that would have that one moment of, this fat woman thinks it's okay to be fat, and, you know, and
yeah, and by your era, I think they tended to have a little bit more of a, like, are you too fat to wear that? Or, like, is it okay to be a sassy fat girl or whatever?
Yeah.
It was a little bit more depoliticized mm-hmm. than in those earlier appearance, because there were, you know, for some people in early NAFA, it wasn't that political, it was social. For some people, it was very political. And certainly for the fat underground, it was very political. Like, yeah. you know, we made a manifesto with political declarations and demands. And so by the sort of Jerry Springer era of, you know, are you too fat for that? It was usually just like, are you allowed to wear stretch pants because you like them and stuff like that? Less, and you know, obviously, again, like, it's, that's still an element of activism, right? Like, you just being your fat ass, mm-hmm. badass self in the world is an element of activism. But that does look different than having like a discussion about fat rights on a talk show. You're just having like people yell at each other about whether they're allowed to be fat or not. Looks a little bit different. So there's sort of like two generations of that talk show fat representation yeah. as well.
Yeah, I mean, and I feel like a lot of that also, you know, went along with those talk shows and this emphasis on like oddities and deviants and all of these people that are doing weird things that, you know, nice suburbanites would not be okay with.
Yeah,
But yeah, I mean, I think that there's a lot of different ways that people, you know, saw fatness online. I mean, or on TV, I should say. And, you know, and right around the time, I mean, obviously, like when I was in high school, that's when reality TV really started to jump off. I mean, I know like Real World obviously started in the 90s, but it really started to ramp up a lot more in the 2000s. And, you know, that also meant that, you know, television shows on channels that I'm not even going to mention, you know, started popping up with, you know, really stigmatizing stories about fatness. You know, Natalie Ingram just popped in and her dissertation looked at The Biggest Loser. And that, you know, the stigma from that, I mean, I can't even, the podcast Maintenance Phase talked about The Biggest Loser and I got so, I couldn't listen to it because it's just so, like, I just have such a visceral reaction to to hearing about it. And so I think that, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of really stigmatizing mainstream dominant narratives about fatness that even while that was happening, there were still these little moments of like seeing fat people as just people that live their lives, and that can still be very powerful. And I'm happy that you got to have that, you know, that moment. So
yeah, and you know, meeting Carrie when, you know, when she did that workshop at Smith, again, it was just sort of like, we're having a workshop about fat people just being people. Like, we shouldn't have to have a workshop about fat people just being people, right? But also, it's revolutionary to have a workshop in 1992 about fat people, and also in 2021 about fat people that's not about defatting them. Yeah. Defatting us, right? So, and I think it's interesting to think about, you know, in those, like, as you trace like fat visibility through things like talk shows and reality television, you know, what you're saying about the element of spectacle and what that looks like in how it, like, I'm sure there's an academic out here doing work on this, and you probably know who it is, around like how that connects with like circus and carnival history of like the bearded lady and the fat lady and like those kind of body deviant rebels / objectified people, you know, like there's, it's really, you know, like some people are watching Are You Too Fat for That on Jerry Springer because they are cheering for the fat person's right to wear what they want. And some people are watching it, you know, for the element of spectacle because they think it like how funny that this fat person thinks they're allowed to do this, right? And so that, all of that shit is like, it's a heady mix of empowerment and problematic when you look at those kinds of representations in pop culture, certainly. And they're usually not representations that are are designed for us by us, right? Yeah. And, you know, I think that one of the things that a lot of early mainstream activists, and I think especially folks who were around NAFA, were very concerned with, that we now would probably talk about as respectability politics and as being problematic, but one of the things they were concerned with was representing fat people quote unquote well, so that people would show fat people more respect. So there's like a way to read that Jerry Springer-ish kind of TV appearance as an FU to respectability politics, right? That is a kind of progress. There's also a way to read it as like a reinforcement of fat stereotype. And so it's all complicated and nuanced and depends on what politics you bring to the reading, right? What politics you bring to the way that you take in the imagery and talk about the imagery and are aware of how other people take in and talk about the imagery. And so like things like that can kind of simultaneously like reinforce stigma and be empowering to different audiences. You know, I think it's really interesting to think about.
Yeah. I mean, even, you know, when I was on Twitter and I was dealing with, and I was also helped moderating the Tumblr blog, This Is Thin Privilege, which is actually where I got all the data for my master's thesis. I was talking about sewing clothes, and part of it was because I was a poor ass grad student that couldn't afford clothes, but also I'm picky as hell and I thought most fat clothes were kind of ugly. And so I started sewing, but like people would have conversations about how particularly for supersized fat folks, finding clothing is horrific and really hard to do. And trolls would be like, well, fat body politics sews her own clothes. Why don't you do that? And I'd be like, whoa, like me sewing clothes is not a sign that someone else can like pull themselves on their bootstraps and grab a sewing machine and make clothing. But there is that, you know, there is that happy medium. And it, for me, it made me like very particular about how I am presenting myself. You know, I'm an avid hiker, but I am very particular in not talking about it all the time. I don't post every time that I go hiking because I don't want to create that representation that this is what fatness is. And this is how you are, you know, creating this acceptable form of fatness. Because it really
does. But it's challenging, right? Because like there's somebody out there who's going to be sick of your feed if you're posting hiking pictures all the time, because why do we have to be good fatties and we don't have to exercise and we're not required to do that. Oh, yeah. And all of that is true. And there's someone else who is a fat hiker who is alone. Like I literally talked to someone today in another meeting about, you know, fat stuff. Who was talking about what it's like to live in the community she lives in and be a fat hiker and not have any other fat hikers around her, right?
Oh, yeah.
And so like, it's so difficult, right? Because part of living our best lives is living our actual lives without the lens of, am I making the rest of the fat people look bad? Am I making the rest of the brown people look bad? Am I making the rest of the women look bad? Like, but like, this is my shit that I do. So do it. I want to do it enthusiastically, right? And so like where we choose to sort of like curate which parts of us we show to the rest of the world based on wanting to make the world easier for our peers, on the one hand is like a beautiful gift to our peers, and on the other hand is like, if this shit wasn't fucked up in the first place, we wouldn't have to do that, right?
Oh, yeah.
So it's super frustrating to think about, like, that's part of what privilege is. Part of privilege is,
oh, yeah,
I just like hiking, so I show my hiking pictures. I don't have to think about what impact it has on other people,
oh, yeah,
you know, in a good way or a bad way. Like, that's part of what privilege is. So, but anyway, I feel like I led us through this tangent because I started talking about talk shows and stuff. And I know that you wanted to get to some of the historical pieces.
Yes.
So let me stop talking. I am a pop culture nerd. Like I love the geeky scholarship stuff I love the nerdy scholarship stuff and I love the geeky scholarship stuff. And so whenever they intersect, whenever we can talk about things like, you know, queering political theory on Jerry Springer, like I love to do that. So, but tell me what you want me to make sure that we get in around the historical pieces.
Yeah, I mean, part of the reason that I asked you to be on the first episode is because obviously no one has read a book yet that I have assigned. But I also really I knew that you would be a good person to talk about and kind of like reminisce about fat stuff over time. And so I am totally fine with you going down a geeky, nerdy rabbit hole. This is like also to like fill me and make me happy and talk about fat stuff just makes me super excited. And so you're good with that, but also, you know, I think it's all right. So yeah, let's talk about NAFA. I think, you know, for me, one of the reasons I wanted to ask you on is obviously you are the chair of the board of NAFA. That's the National Association to Advance Fat Acceptance. It is the oldest fat liberation organization in the United States, I'm pretty sure in the world as well. And, you know, and it has a very rich history that really aligns with, and I think something that people, to give context to the time that it started, it really aligns with where the civil rights movement and the second wave feminist movement, you know, it was during this really amazing time of social change that fat liberation came out of too. And I think that that's a really important place for this, you know, book club to start with, because I want people to understand this history. So where did NAFA begin?
So NAFA begins in 1969. This is the summer of Stonewall. This is the summer of the Alcatraz occupation. This is the summer of is it the moon landing summer? It's the moon landing summer, right? It's also the summer of Sesame Street. I told you I'm a pop culture nerd, and Sesame Street is hugely important to social justice and education and access for young mm-hmm. people of color, especially urban people of color, especially. And you know, there are all these like really amazing things that happened in 1969. And it is when NAFA is founded by a then young activist, a young engineer named Bill Fabry. I want to go back just a little bit before that. In the summer of 1967, a New York City disc jockey named Steve Post called for a fad-in in Central Park. And so that is documented as the first sort of explicitly fat visibility gathering, right? It's like 500 people show up in the park. There are nowhere that I can find, and I can't say that any other scholars I know have found this either, photographs that exist from this. There's a piece in the New York Times that describes it and quotes Steve Post about it. But if you know folks who were at that have pictures, we know cameras weren't in everybody's pockets in 1967. So it's unlikely that there are surviving photos of this. But if you got a hot lead, please let me know. So we don't know if all 500 people were fat people, right? Like, we don't know who was there because they like fat people, because they wanted to come see the spectacle, because they wanted whatever. But we know there were fat people who showed up at the park with the premise of, we are fat and proud. We don't have to apologize for that. Here we are. That's 1967. So that's really the first documented in the world, the first documented fat visibility thing, right? It's like the grandparent of the let it all hang out, the grand elder of the let it all hang out celebration in San Francisco, and the fat flash mob that happened in, you know, different cities in also San Francisco, but also in some different cities in 2015. And like, it's the grand elder of that, right? Before that moment, we know that there are fat people in arts, entertainment, you know, in their regular lives, certainly in other social justice movements, that are just unapologetically fat, doing their business, taking leadership in communities. We know that's especially an important presence in the Black American Civil Rights Movement. We know there's evidence of that in LGBTQIA history. Like, we know that there are fat people, like, rocking their shit in all kinds of ways that are not what, you know, what we sort of classify as like the movement, right? But we have to honor those folks. But the movement, like, that moment in Central Park sparks, is the beginning of something. And then the next year, an author named Lou Lauterbach writes a piece in the Saturday Evening Post, and it's sort of hard to like really help people understand how big of a deal the Saturday Evening Post was at that time in this, like, newspapers and magazines are how we get the news kind of time. But he writes a piece in the Saturday Evening Post called, the title is something like Everyone Should Be Fat. And it is an editorial credited to Lou, and I think sort of co-authored by his wife. And it has a picture of Lou, and it's basically like the argument is it's not everybody should be fat as in you should all gain fat with us, but it's like, it's basically like if we all let go of our, what we would now call diet culture shit, right? Like if we all let go of, I think they referred to it as the hamster wheel of dieting, we would, if we stopped being so obsessed with this and settled into just what our bodies naturally are, there'd be a lot more fat people in the world. And at the time, Bill Fabry is, you know, again, a young engineer with his wife, Joyce, is a fat woman who he is witnessing all the time her suffering in the world. You know, the way that weight stigma affects her in terms of social life, in terms of fashion, in terms of employment, all of these things. And he's been thinking about what could we do? And so when he sees this piece in the Saturday Evening Post, he writes away to Lou, like, and I think they actually met up together in New York, in the city, to like, let's talk about this. And they ultimately start the start NAFA together, and the small group that was part of the founding of NAFA designated Bill Fabry as the founder. And Bill, you know, is active in NAFA leadership into the 90s and is active in fat activist world into now. Like, he's 80 and still doing fat activism stuff. He's the head of the Council on Size and Weight Discrimination. He's been on the board of ASDA, which is the Association for Size Diversity and Health. So, like, Bill is still in it 52 years later. You know, and those other founding members have mostly passed on or are not involved anymore. And so NAFA starts in 1969 as this little group of folks, some of them, you know, like thin, cis, straight guys and their fat wives, and some of them, you know, other fat people. So it's like a conglomerate of allies and people who are fat identified themselves. And as NAFA starts to grow, there is also, you know, there's involvement from people all over the country. And some of that involvement is from some radical feminist women in the Los Angeles area who just, like, they want to see what NAFA is going to do, but they also can already see it's not going to be radical enough for what they want to do. And they form an organization called the Fat Underground. And the Fat Underground publishes the Fat Liberation Manifesto, which is a 10-point document aligning fat movement with other social justice causes, you know, declaring the shrinking industries, what we would now call the diet industries, as, you know, the enemy of fat people, criticizing advertising and media for their portrayals of fat people, criticizing medical science for its treatment and its substantiation of lies about fat health. Like, this is really the foundational document of the organized movement, and what kind of should have grounded the whole movement in intersectionality. It grounds the most sort of lefty radical parts of the movement, which is a lot led by like feminist lesbian groups and women's groups. It grounds them in intersectionality. It does not do NAFA is not grounded in intersectionality at the beginning of the movement. Mm-hmm. So that's the start. And, you know, NAFA continues to grow and spread across the country. There are places, you know, activism is popping up in other places. And one of the notable places in the 1980s is the London Women's Group, you know, and then, like, and a lot of things that are first in, that we see happen a lot in fat community now, in political fat community, in plus size fashion, and, you know, all of these different aspects of fat community start in NAFA spaces, because NAFA is the place where the gatherings are happening, right? So fat pool parties, fat fashion shows, like things like that, sometimes happen first at NAFA, or are documented as having happened first at NAFA.
Yes, thank you for that. I did just want to note, Margie in the comments also mentioned that there was a third world strike in San Francisco. Is it State University in 1967? So again, you know, really these roots are happening, you know, right after we had civil rights legislation being put into place, but also happening while the civil rights movement is still, you know, pushing to create, you know, a more equal society. You start to see second wave feminism happening. And I really think, like, for me, the Fat Underground and that document really was, oh, we got a cat. Surprised it took that long. Really was the foundational document for me in really thinking about fatness as and fat liberation as an anti-capitalist project. Mm-hmm. You know, and this is very much part of, as, I mean, I'm a sociologist, so like that is, I'm always thinking about, you know, the aspect of where power comes from, who has power, and how does it exert control over people. And I think for, you know, the it was, you know, really amazing that we have this document that, you know, I think there's only like one place on the internet that I know of that has it, is a Tumblr blog. But I would really love...
The Fat Liberation, the manifesto, you can, if you Google Fat Liberation Manifesto, it'll come up in a few different places.
Okay.
There is only one place where the video of the Fat Underground exists. There was a video that the Fat Underground produced in, I think, 73, 74, mm-hmm. where they share the manifesto, and they also talk about other aspects of fat life and what the work that they're doing in a variety of ways. It's a little grainy, a little hard to hear, but it is on YouTube. So if you Google Fat Underground on YouTube, if you go to YouTube and search Fat Underground, you can find that video and hear them talk about their work in their own words. And the Fat Underground is like sometimes talked about as like the counterpoint of NAFA, right? The fat feminist organization. Mm-hmm. The Fat Underground is the most prominent of them. But, in the 80s, in the 70s and 80s, there are fat feminist groups in other cities that mm-hmm. are doing work that's very much in partnership with people who were in the Fat Underground, mm-hmm. Like I think of, Judith Stein in Boston, and there were some women in Newark, and there were these other, or maybe New Haven, there are these other, feminist collectives. And I would probably say, I wouldn't call them women's groups because I think that, they included participation of some folks who now do not identify as women, but at the time probably didn't have other socially acceptable language to talk about their gender mm-hmm. identities. But those were, those were radical groups. So they were going to be including those folks, right? In a way that like that wasn't even on NAFA's radar. There was, NAFA had a feminist caucus. Sometimes the sort of like NAFA and the Fat Underground are talked about as counterpoints to each other in a way that's adversarial. And there may have been some of that spirit, but like people like Judy Free Spirit, who's one of the, co-founders of the Underground and one of the co-writers of the manifesto, they continued to do work with NAFA. Like they could see ways that NAFA was going to be, have shortcomings in terms of radical politics. Mm-hmm. But they also wanted to be in community with the fat people who were gathering there and help bring some of those folks along and do work together. So it wasn't like, there was resistance sometimes from NAFA leadership. Yeah. And there was active resistance and there was passive resistance, and Bill Fabry will talk publicly about like the ways that he knows that under his leadership, there was that his leadership supported an attitude at NAFA of like, but our job is to talk about the fat people. So why are we talking about race? Why are we talking about sexuality? Like, why are we good for them for doing that? The other people who are doing that work. And sometimes there were times when NAFA reached out to other, to groups in other movements and were rejected because they didn't want to be associated with fat people. And sometimes NAFA didn't reach out to groups in other movements because they just weren't thinking about it, right? Like it was, 52 years of history is a long time and there are a lot of versions of NAFA. And what we hope is that the current version of NAFA is living up to our goal of being a much more intersectional organization. Mm-hmm. We know that that's not what the history of NAFA looks like. Like everybody here who knows NAFA probably knows that that's not what the history of NAFA looks like on the whole. And we never want to erase the folks who were there, right? Like we never want it to be like, NAFA was all white, straight people, with these cisgender men leading the, no. There was a lot of female leadership. There were, queer identified folks who were doing things with and for NAFA. There were Black and Brown people who were doing things with and for NAFA, but those numbers were small and they were not centered. Mm-hmm. And so like, that's going to be an important part as folks are reading the books on your list and going through this, book club with you, looking at what intersectionality looks like throughout the history of fat liberation movement from NAFA, from other, and NAFA is not the movement, right? Like NAFA is a really important starting place in the movement, again, in the documented organized movement. And then there's all this spread over the three waves of fat activism, right? Yeah. But across that spread, we see lots of places who were failing at intersectionality until more modern activism. So like, I really wanna just give sort of like super credit the Fat Underground for their forethought in that way and their commitment to that in terms of philosophy and practice. And then also like the Fat Underground still predominantly white too. Mm-hmm. Right. And so like, there's it's all complicated and we need to look at all the complications, own the shit where the movement wasn't getting everybody in, figure out how we can work harder to get everybody in, mm-hmm. And recognize the way that, and again, like this is something that, Sandra Salve emphasized a lot in her work, and you know, in working with the Fat Rights Project that we mentioned earlier, that anti-fatness is something that disproportionately affects people of color mm-hmm. and people in other marginalized bodies. And so, like, what are we doing movement-wise around that? Sometimes the historical movement got it, or got it in pockets, or got it in places, and sometimes it really didn't. So how do we reconcile that history, leverage the positive parts of that history, and the, you know, the privilege that comes with the longevity of that history, but also not pretend that that's not the history?
Yeah, and I think that, you know, some of the books that I've included in my additional reading section that aren't fat related is because I really want to also acknowledge that this is a symptom that many social movements that began or were, you know, were contending with social issues in the 60s and early 70s, you know, I mean, Black women in the civil rights movement were often erased and their labor was ignored. But also when they would go to organizations like the National Organization for Women, there wouldn't be space for Black women either. And so then that's where we started to have, you know, womenism coming up and Black feminist thought coming up. And so there was really this, you know, the whiteness became such a prominent part of many social movements, but there has been such a great move. And I really think, like, a lot of the books that I've seen come out over the last 5 years-ish have predominantly been written by Black and Brown folks, which I think is amazing. But there's also one book that I really think is great. Actually, two of them. One is by Mickey Kindle. It's called Hood Feminism. And then the other one is this book called, I think it's White Skin, Brown Tears, or White Tears, Brown Skin. I'm terrible at remembering book names sometimes. But that's also on my list. And again, it really talks about how intersectionality needs to happen, but that social movements have often not been intersectional and not been intersectional in many ways. I mean, I think that from my understanding of the Fat Underground as well, is that the reason they started the Fat Underground is because they also tried to find space at the National Organization for Women, and there wasn't space for them there either, you know? And so they decided yeah. to find a space and create a space for themselves to be able to talk about fatness as a, you know, as a political identity. And, you know, and so they went to all of these different places. I mean, this is the same thing with why, you know, No Lose started. It wasn't simply just, you know, because another organization wanted to start it, but they wanted to have a queer, you know, organization that was for queer fat lesbians in the beginning. And now is obviously, you know, they're no longer the National Organization for Lesbians of Size. They're now No Lose because they want to be inclusive to, you know, gender and sexual orientation. But it, you know, it.
But centering marginalized experiences in, you know, yes. and marginalized identities in that. And that's how lots of, you know, like at the beginning of this, you said something like, I'm just going to do stuff if people don't let me, right? I'm going to find a way to do yeah. it myself if people don't let me. That's the spirit of fat activist movement, mm-hmm. and it's the spirit of contemporary fat liberation activists, mm-hmm. right? If y'all don't make a space for me, I'll make a space. But we, you know, so, and, you know, like, yay. Like, let's do, like, that's how I got started in fat mm-hmm. activism, right? Like, I was going to plus size nightclub events. They were not particularly welcoming of Black and Brown women. Mm-hmm. I decided to start one that centered Black and Brown women. That's how I entered. I didn't enter through, you know, organized activism. I entered through trying to throw a party. Right. Yeah. So that's what we do. And that's what activists have done throughout our history. And you're right. Like, sometimes that has been a result of other movements' lack of intersectionality and their lack of acknowledgement that fatness was part of, mm-hmm. Was a social justice issue, not just a personal and individual problem, right?
Yeah.
Or not a problem at there, you know, not a problem at all. The problem is the systems, the structures, whatever. And so, you know, I think that's really important. And I think, you know, the but again, that piece around like acknowledging that part of what we identify as the movement in any of these movements has to do with, like, historical white supremacist structures and what it sees as movement, or like what it sees as being organized enough. And like, you know, like talking about Black feminism coming out of there not being space in white movement in the 70s and not room in the National Organization of Women. Yes. And also not room in the first wave of, like, not room in the suffrage movement. And then Black women were kicking ass with suffrage efforts and helped pass suffrage. Like, and Black women have been writing and doing, like, written feminist thought since Black women could write everywhere all over the world. Right. Mm-hmm. But we don't think of that as part of the scholarship. Well, that's a problem with us, right?
Yeah.
And so, like, the parallel in our movement is, yes, you know, what we see as the movement often did not involve participation of Black and brown folks at the same level that it involved other people, partly because they were busy with the other movements, right? But part of, like, the false narrative that gets created out of that sometimes is Black and brown people didn't need fat liberation because their communities were so accepting of fat people. Yes and no. And that's a very nuanced community discussion around, like, what fat acceptance looks like in Black and brown communities. But the idea that, like, fat Black and brown people don't need fat lib, well, if fat lib's work is to protect the rights of fat people, that includes the fat and Black and brown people. And even if it were true that our communities were 100% accepting of fatness, we can't economically exist only within our communities. That's not a reality of modern life in this world, right? We have to go out amongst the other people and deal with their anti-fatness, even if our communities were purely protective at home. And they're not purely protective at home. Anyway, the point is, like, there's always all of this, like, nuance and, like, opportunity for us to really examine the narratives that exist, the absence of other narratives, and, like, what all that means when it comes together.
Yeah, and I think, you know, one thing that I'm really fascinated by, and I think particularly reflecting on my early time as an activist and feeling like, you know, I have to do activism, but I have to be, like, well-known, and I have to be, you know, someone that is changing the world, when in reality, the vast majority of people that are doing that work are people that are doing these, you know, are doing work in their communities and working with other organizations and bringing in that add in there, you know, added analysis that they have of their own life and of fatness and race and, you know, all of these different forms of marginalization. And so being able to, you know, to really think about fat liberation as, you know, a ongoing process. And it isn't just one person that's going to save us all, but it is a collective of people, you know, I really feel like is, you know, for me is, like, makes my fat activist heart very happy, but also feels very rooted in what was written in the Fat Liberation Manifesto, and is really at its core, you know, what I feel is rooted in, you know, the Communist Manifesto and other, you know, readings of just social movements in general. And that, you know, we really can expand past just thinking about, you know, well, NAFTA started in the 70s, and that's when, you know, fat activism began, versus NAFTA started in the 70s, and that was the first, formal organization that went through the process of getting, you know, a tax status and stuff, you know, which is very different. I mean, I have never worked in, I have never been part of an organization. I mean, Allied Abundant Bodies has tax status because we're under Allied Media Conference, but I've never worked in, like, a formal activist organization. That isn't how most activist organizations happen. People see that a problem's going on in their community and they want to fix it. And so they try to find a way to do that by bringing people together. And so I'm really, you know, interested in kind of, like, muddling through that ambiguity and figuring out how, you know, how it all sorts out, you know, and it's, I'm really excited that you came on. We're definitely not done.
Yeah.
Because I'm
You know, I think the two of us together was probably never going to be a like, oh, we're going to do this in a tight little hour. But
okay.
Can we like before you sign off, can I just show a couple of more books since it's a book club?
Absolutely. Okay. I'm Joy Cox's. I already know which book you're talking about. I want Joy Cox to be on this. That book is amazing. I'm trying to get Sabrina Strings to be on in her book, Fearing the Black Body.
I don't know what happened, but I was just going to sit here and keep on holding up Deshaun's book until something, you know, reconnected. Like, that's where I lost the rest of you. I don't know if that's where it went down for everybody, but I was just like, I'm going to just, here we are until it comes back.
Yeah, it's all right. Yes. I, you know, there's been so many amazing books, and I am really interested in centering anti-Blackness and centering, you know, queer history and obviously feminist history and all of that, disability studies research, and really centering how, you know, intersectional fatness and fat experience is, but also getting people to really think critically about the way that, you know, I'm always really interested when I'm teaching classes to get the people that are in my class to think about the space that they take up as an individual. And how their experience is different. You know, for me as a white fat woman in the city of Detroit, you know, I am very aware of the fact that whiteness is protective, and I do not deal with the same type of interpersonal fat stigma that Black and brown people do in the city. And it is, you know, it is ever present though, if I am going out of the city into white suburbs, where, you know, Black and brown folks are still dealing with racism out there as well, you know. And so I think that thinking about how our, like, the space that we take up as individuals in this movement for people that are interested in it to engage with fat liberation, I think is a really amazing place for us to kind of change that narrative and really start to, I don't want to say heal from the history of, you know, fat liberation, but really continue and place an emphasis on, you know, acknowledging the history of the fat liberation and where we could go from here, you know? And so that to me is like really important, and why I'm also just super jazzed about all of the really amazing books that have come out over the last 5 years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's just not enough reading. And like, I need more reading time. I need more reading time. And, but I am really excited about the, you know, the ones that I held up. There are some others that I also love, but like for a theory club, I think these are some great starting places. Yeah. Around, specifically around intersections, both historical and contemporary intersections around, you know, around race and bodies and fat. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think it's really, I'm glad folks hung in there, even though we went long, and
yes.
So I'm super grateful that you invited me to just sort of like, you know, help kick off these discussions with some history and some context and some, like, you know, just, I love the piece about just doing some personal getting to know you with other people who are in the movement. Because it also just reminds people of that sort of like that thing about like, one time Sonya Renee Taylor said, I'm hella regular, y'all. Like, y'all think I'm like, you can't, I'm, you know, I'm Sonya Renee Taylor. I'm regular. Talk to me. Invite me to stuff. You know, invite me to your party. Don't just invite me to speak at your conference kind of thing. And like, we're, you know, like, I think it can be really easy to do this sort of like, y'all see, if you follow me from here, if you're not already following me and you follow me from here, you say, I don't even have 3,000 followers on Instagram. I'm not fat famous like that, you know, and that doesn't mean that I'm not doing the work, and I've been doing the work for a long time. And so, but there are a lot of people like that in our movement. So getting to hear the stories from those folks too, I think is just really, is really important. And like, I do have a bigger platform now as the chair of NAFA because of NAFA's history, because of NAFA's longevity. And there are, that does open doors for me that didn't get opened before, you know, and you talked about privilege. Like, I, you know, I have education, I have skin color privilege, I have, you know, the ability to navigate systems that some people are not familiar with. Like, those pieces are all pieces that I can put into play, but there are other folks who have essential other skills that we need in this, mm-hmm. in this movement. So it's super important for us to be able to meet in a variety of spaces, not only in classrooms, not only in conferences. And so, like, I'm super excited to see that you are taking this to Instagram.
Yeah, I mean, I'm super excited. I've joked around about a lot of different podcasts that I could do. But I think that this is good too, you know, as La Chupa. I'm like gonna totally ruin.
La Chalupa.
Yeah, there you go. Sorry. Yes, you said you haven't read any, read or studied anything about fat liberation and social justice circles, you know. Coming up as a women's studies and sociology major, and now, you know, moving on to being a PhD candidate, I think it was always like a footnote that there was maybe a chapter that they would assign in like a women's studies class, but it never was like a full week where we were thinking about fat liberation. And I think that for me, one of the most common questions that I get from people that do want to bring it into their classroom is, where do they start? What books should they assign? And so that's kind of what I want to do with this as well, is I really want to give educators and other people a good place to start and a good place to, you know, to look for, you know, for where, you know, what books they can pull from and like what is a good, you know, text to look into to really have that basic knowledge. And, you know, I'm really excited about kind of diving into these books, but also making them accessible to people. And so, you know, yeah. As I said, I'm very excited that you came along and agreed to be my first guest. I think you were the best person for the job, because I think it's amazing to have a Black woman as the chair of not just NAFA, but a Black woman as a chair of NOLOOS as well. You know, mm-hmm. This is a very amazing time in fat liberation history.
ASDA also has a tremendous leadership team that is now like predominantly, I think maybe even exclusively people of color with their new elections. And so like there's, you know, there's definitely an increase in the organized movement understanding that there needs to be, some shifting around who is centered and whose leadership we listen to and take guidance from and all of that. And it is all over the movement. And it is also really evident in these fresh, newer groups that don't really, or like web presences or whatever that don't get talked about as groups, but that bring these like really important perspectives. Like I'm thinking about the Fat Futures Collective, or like, you know, just other, you know, individual activist work, like Saucy's Fight for Inclusivity campaign in the fashion world. Like there's so much LGBTQ leadership in Fat Rose, and obviously in NOLOOS, and like, and in ASDA, and like I'm looking at who our board candidates are for this year. NAFA's in the middle of a board search. I think we're like, it's gonna look like a whole different kind of board than what NAFA's board historically looked like when we finished this search, based on the people that we have in the pool. And so it's a really exciting time of change for our movement. You know, it's really exciting.
Yeah. And I've seen just, you know, being in the activist community and like organizing community in Detroit, I've really seen a change from when I first started doing stuff to now, where people really are thinking about bodies and weight in a way that is very critical and are trying to add it to their analysis and create an intersectional analysis that is talking about all of these different marginalized identities. And I think that that's, you know, amazing. You know, one of the first sessions that we did when I was organizing with Abundant Bodies, we did a session about weight in healthcare. And the vast majority of people that came to that were thin, but they were people in the medical industry that really wanted to, you know, that were nurses or doctors, and they really wanted to make sure that their practice and where they were working was accessible. I mean, I've spoken to Planned Parenthood a couple times in Detroit because, again, they're interested in making their practices accessible. And I think that that type of work, you know, isn't necessarily coming out of a, you know, out of NAFA specifically, but that there are people that are really thriving and thirsty for this type of, you know, knowledge and how they can apply it to, you know, their jobs and where they are in their own life and the community work that they're doing. And I think that that's, you know, I'm going to say it's my jam 50 billion times in this project, but it is, it makes me so happy and it makes me like so excited. Cause you know, every once in a while, people still get shocked when I use the word fat and I'm just like, where have you been? Like,
yeah. You know. Well, thank you for bringing, like I said, thank you for bringing this to Instagram. I'm excited to read along with you. Yes. And to be a participant in future. I know you're lining up some future guests and, you know, and preparing some support resources for, you know, for doing the, for, you know, for folks who are doing the recommended readings. And I know that your book list is, for people who already read whatever's on the recommended one for that month, that your book list has a lot for folks to go into of other things that they could be reading. So, so thank you again for having me. And I just want to say thank you again to everybody who hung in here for so long to listen to us.
Yeah. And just to finish off this, episode, I'm hoping that both videos get posted to my Instagram so I can convert them to a podcast, but they will be available on a podcast on Monday. That's when I plan on dropping it. So, you know, really hoping that this will be accessible because I can add captions to it anyone can add captions to videos on Instagram so that you can, you know, not just hear it, but see it. And then also for people that don't want to have their screen open to Instagram to watch the whole video, I thought that having it on a podcast would be good. But so our next meeting for the Fat Theory Book Club will be December 10th. It's the second Friday of every month. That's my goal. The only time that it'll change is if I get a guest that really needs it to be a different day. Because once I start getting into trying to get academics, everyone's so busy and I get schedules may not align. But for next month, the books that we're going to be talking about are Marilyn Wan's book, Fat! ! And Kathleen Lebesco's book, Revolting Bodies. Both of these books, again, are not necessarily the beginning of the fat movement, but I think do a really good job of getting us to think about the type of activism that we see classically today about visibility and, but also kind of campiness and like fun type of activism. And then also Kathleen Lebesco's book is just a really good, it's definitely an academic book. She pulls a lot from Judith Butler, but really thinking about fatness as an identity and not simply just as a, you know, disease or condition or state of the body. And, you know, it's just a really great book that I personally love. And I think it's a really great place to start. Right now, I'm hoping in January that we'll be talking about Fearing the Black Body by Dr. Sabrina Strings. I'm trying to get her to come on, although I have many other people that I can pull and work it out so that maybe she's not on the day that we're actually reading her book. But that is also just an amazing, amazing book. And I think does a really good job of a historical analysis of how, not just how whiteness was constructed and white beauty ideals and body ideals, but on the flip side, how blackness was constructed and you know, and how those two things are happening simultaneously. And really even today still have a very significant impact in the daily lives of, you know, fat people, black people, brown people, I mean, everyone. So yeah, thank you again, Tigress, for coming on for this first episode. Thank you everyone who came to the first video and jumped back on for the second. I really appreciate it. You can, again, follow Tigress on Eye of the Tigress, I with the letter I, not I as in your eyeball. And then you can follow me. That's how I'm going to do it from now on. That's how I'm going to describe you. And then you can follow me on Instagram. I'm whimsicalfemme. On Twitter and sometimes on TikTok. I am Fat Body Politics. You can find the complete list of books that I'm going to be pulling from for the Fat Theory Book Club at my website. It's amanda-levitt.com. There's an entire page for it. And I will also be posting links to the podcast and the links to both of the videos so that you can look at them as well. So thank you so much. Really appreciate everyone that turned out. And I think this went really well.
Thank you for having me. Before you hang it up, I'm going to take a screenshot. So get yourself the way you want to look in the screenshot.
Steve.
Thank you. Oh, wait, that was too soon. I'm trying to screenshot it from my other device and there's a little bit of a delay. Let's try that again because we want to be cute. I want to be cute this time. Sometimes I don't care if I'm cute or not, but. Oh my God. There's such a delay. Someone else who's watching, take a screenshot and send it to us while we're cute.
I mean, I could take a screenshot maybe. Hold on. Ready? Yeah, mine happened right away.
Good. Okay, perfect. Love it. Thank you for indulging me in that. Fat vanity is a part of fat visibility. Let's do it. And thank you all again.
Yes, thank you, everyone. This was a great. See you on December 10th.